Hello, everyone. This is Dave Levinsky from Growth Inc., and today I'm really excited to interview Jeff Bowling. Jeff is a U.S. Army veteran turned successful entrepreneur. He's the founder and CEO of Telzar, a global information technology company, which he successfully grew and sold. And I had the pleasure of working with Jeff on the Telzar business plan back in 2003 and 2004. Jeff has also founded and sold several other companies, and importantly, he's done this each time without the need for much funding. He's also done this on his own terms, meaning that he's been able to achieve significant success while still spending a lot of time, a lot of quality time with his wife and daughters and doing the things he enjoys. Jeff recently came out with an absolutely great book called If You Never Quit, You'll Never Fail, Memoir of a Young Entrepreneur. And I've honestly never seen a book quite like it. On one hand, it's like a biography of somebody who's lived an action-packed life. I mean, Jeff, some of your stories are like could be made into a movie. And on the other hand, there's a lot of great entrepreneurship lessons about starting, building, and building a business. So we'll talk more about that in a moment. And then finally, Jeff is now the managing partner of Bowling Ventures, which you can find at bowlingventures.com. That's B-O-W-L-I-N-G-Ventures.com. And which helps entrepreneurs with strategic planning, life coaching, information strategy, and business building. So, Jeff, thanks so much for taking the time out of your schedule to speak with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Excellent. So, Jeff, the entrepreneurs listening to the call are the ones that want to do exactly what you have done, which is, you know, building successful companies that they can sell. You know, what do you think are the keys to doing that?
One of the things you have to look at is you have to look at entrepreneurs themselves. They're a total different breed of people, and it's interesting to me. I read a ton of books on how people have come about into money, into building companies, into changing their life, and some entrepreneurs are entrepreneurs from the get-go. They don't have places they fit in like me, where you've worked at a ton of different companies, you've done a lot of great things, but you really haven't found a place that you know you really fit into. The other thing that was important with me is that things don't move as fast as I'd like them to move. These are key things that entrepreneurs need to have is understanding that they don't fit the actual norm. And okay. So there's other people that have worked for 20 years and they say, you know, I'm going to retire. I've got some money in the bank. I'm going to develop this product. And they become entrepreneurs later on in life. But entrepreneurs really are a different breed of people. I mean, we can all attest to that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's say we have an entrepreneur and someone has that, either they don't fit in or they have that entrepreneurial mindset that they have this idea and they are just, you know, completely set on taking that idea to market and growing it into a successful company. What do you think are the keys to doing that? What do you see with entrepreneurs that are successful and do what you did with building a company and selling it versus entrepreneurs that don't achieve that level of success? Because as you know, most of them don't achieve that level. So what do you think of those key differences?
There's really a lot of key differences, but I can probably sum it up to two things.
Okay.
Perseverance, you know, and being incredibly tenacious and not accepting no.
Okay.
I mean, those would be the two key things is, you know, standing your ground, stating the, you know, what your product does, what you want to do, believing in your product, and then having the ability to stick behind that and stay true to your guns. I mean, you have to be tenacious. You have to be willing to work hard. You can't just develop a widget, expect to get $100 million for that widget, and then you're going to retire on an island somewhere. It does not work that way. You know, I've actually built and sold six companies, and each time every company got bigger and bigger. So I didn't start off right off the bat, you know, with a company and hit a home run right out of the park. I never went bankrupt, but I never made a killing until later on in life when I started developing other companies and learning more things. But, you know, Telzar was my sixth company that I built and sold on my own, and it takes quite a while, and you got to be willing to work hard, but, I mean, you got to stick to your guns.
Got it. And what was it about the company, your six companies, that you felt made them sellable, made them why somebody would wanted to buy them? What had you built that somebody else said, yeah, I really want to buy and take over what you've built?
That's actually an interesting question because each company, I think, was bought for something different. But one thing I can pick is that usually I got a company to a specific point that I would make a goal. I would get a company to a specific point, and I would try to sell the companies within 5 years of building them. Telstar was the only company that I had for 11 years. And the only reason why I did it is because the money and the volume, and there were so many things to do with Telstar. It was so diversified. You were never tired. You were never bored. You were never just sitting still. There were just so many things in technology that I wanted to do. And Telstar was all the other five companies it took to build Telstar, because that was my dream company. But one of the interesting thing about the building the companies and making the companies able to sell is, and I decided that I wanted to exit out and build an exit strategy. And mind you, I don't build a company with an exit strategy first. I think that's backwards thinking.
Jeff, I built a really good company.
Yeah.
Jeff, you're breaking up a little bit. I don't know if it's my phone or yours, but if you can, I don't know if you moved or anything. It's very choppy right now.
It's still choppy?
It's still a little bit choppy.
All right, here I am. I'm actually out in my office. I got pretty good signal. How about now?
Now it's perfect. Sorry about that.
Okay. No, that's no problem at all. So I didn't know you got...
Actually, Jeff, it's bad again. I don't know if you moved from the original position or where you were a second ago, but it got fuzzy again.
Really? All right, well, here, let me go out into the courtyard. Hang on, Dave, just a sec.
Okay.
I'll walk out into the courtyard.
Now it's great when you're talking.
Okay, yeah, I'm just walking out into the courtyard. My office is, we got a two-story office with a warehouse down below us.
Okay,
is it good now?
Now it's good, yeah.
Okay, all right, so I don't know if you got the part of building the company where I don't focus on building my companies with the exit in mind first.
Okay.
And yeah. I don't know if you got that. I usually, the other companies, I only had them for a few years, and my goal used to be to build a good company, and then I would sell it. And I took steps from five businesses up until I got to Telstar.
Okay.
And Telstar was unique because that company I had for 11 years.
Right.
And so the reason why I had that company so long is we were doing so many things. There was so much diverse technology. Telstar was my dream company. That's what I worked my whole life to build, was Telstar, and that's why I stayed with that company for so long.
Got it.
But when I build a business and I decide, okay, in 24 months, I want to exit out of the company itself, during the point that I start the company until the point that I exit out of the company, I learn about my competition. I learn about, you know, who's doing what in the industry, but I don't focus and constantly follow and fester about my competition. When I'm ready to execute an exit strategy, within 24 to 36 months of that strategy, I become a thorn in their side. I start taking as much market share as I can from them. I start diversifying my services, and I make sure that they are well aware of me within my last 24 to 36 months, because most of my companies are incredibly technical. They're not like I'm going out and building a company that sells mops and anybody can come in and learn how to sell mops. Most of my companies are very, very sophisticated and technical, so my barrier of entry is greater, but also my barrier of exit is greater as well. I have to find people that know what I do.
Right.
So I became a thorn in their sides, and I had my competitors actually acquire almost every single company of mine was acquired by a competitor.
Hmm. That's very, very interesting. Talk about becoming a thorn in your competitor's side. What are some examples of that?
One of the misconceptions about business is you have to be first to market. If you're not first to market, you're nothing. And I disagree with that 100%. I think the people that are second, third, fourth, and fifth, and so on to market actually make more than the first person. And a good case in point of this is Apple. I mean, Apple is a very innovative company. They have great products. They've done iTunes, you know, they've done the iPad. They've done all these wonderful things. But there's literally thousands of companies behind them that are now going to duplicate this and make even more money than Apple did doing the things that they innovated. And yeah, they were first to market. But being first to market means that you have 1,000 competitors sitting back watching every single thing you do, nitpicking at it, changing it, so that it works better in the market. And so being first to market isn't always the greatest. I love markets that are oversaturated, especially service-based and professional service markets.
Got
And
it.
so to become a thorn in someone's side, it depends on what market you're trying to penetrate, what your goal and your focus is. So for ours with Telzar, it was information technology services. And one thing that was really interesting about that is Cisco actually got us into the data center building business. And so when we first started Telzar, all we were focused on was web and e-commerce and a little bit of networking. And because I had a background working for large IT services firms, we started offering IT services. Then after that, we started offering the circuits that went to those customers, like T1s and DS3s. Then after that, we started offering the data centers that the circuits were housed in, and so on and so forth, until we had about 5 to 8 different services, and we did this all under the cloak of darkness because we were a nobody. We were coming, you know, to the game as the 1,000th company or the 20,000th company, you know? And
right.
So no one really knew who we were, how big we were, until we started doing a lot of PR, a lot of marketing, when we decided we were going to leave the company. And all of a sudden on the scene, we came on, and there was just a panic. We had AT&T calling us. We had Deutsche Telekom calling us. We had IBM Global Services calling us. And then when they found out we'd been in business for all these years, they were floored. They were blown away that we had so much market share.
Gotcha. They were calling you because you
and
started
so
doing a big PR push?
Yeah, we started doing big PR pushes, but more importantly, they started seeing our equipment in all the data centers that they were working in.
Got it. Okay.
And so we actually had AT&T as a client. We had Nevada Bell as a client before they acquired them. We had SBC as a client, and we started building data centers with them. And then IBM started seeing us in the data centers. And this is like year 5 or 6 of the company, you know,
right.
It's not the first year of the company. And so at that time we had so much market share building up that we had people coming in saying, hey, would you help us build this data center? Hey, would you help us build that data center? So when we started doing some marketing and PR about 36 months ago, and we started hitting of the fact that there were people looking to acquire us and all that, the feeding frenzy just started. So once people knew that there were people actively looking to acquire us, that in itself created another bounce for us, so that we had other offers coming to the table. We didn't just have one.
Got it. Excellent. Very, very, very interesting. What do you think that other companies are doing what mistakes do you see, you think other companies and other entrepreneurs are making today? And if you walked into like the average company, what do you think those mistakes would be? And what do you think you would be doing to improve it if you were, you know, working with some of these companies?
Actually, that's what I do with Bowling Ventures. And I'm going to tell you two things, and people are probably going to disagree with me and think that I'm crazy.
Okay.
One, there's way too much social activity online happening that's detracting away from productivity. What I mean by that is there are way too many people that don't understand Twitter, Facebook, you know, any of the social sites, and think that all of their marketing, all of their production, all their performance lies, you know, online in that social environment. And all their employees are constantly online and in that social environment. In fact, we did an 11-year study at Telzar, and as the social environment started kicking up, we're going to be publishing a book based off of this about how we disabled Facebook, Twitter, and increased our productivity. And I'm not saying those are bad services. You know, we blocked a whole bunch of other websites too, like Craigslist and eBay. But what we were doing is we were taking out all the extra variables away from that employee that didn't focus on their specific job. So they weren't sitting there tweeting their friends. They weren't doing Facebook. They were actually fundamentally paid to do a job, and they were doing it, and the company was producing great results because of it. The number two thing that's incredibly important that I see, and probably the number one reason why most companies fail, is management. People's management skills have decreased so rapidly. People's interaction skills, managers aren't watching teams, aren't watching staff. There's either too many managers at a company or not enough, or there's too many managers that aren't online with one specific goal, or no one knows the goal and everybody's just working to stay under a budget. So those are probably the two things that I see the biggest failures, and management would probably be up there as number one. Most people will tell you companies don't fail because the product sucked. Companies fail because managers failed to manage the company, sell the product, manage the support. I mean, your biggest failure in companies nowadays are people, guaranteed.
What do you think?
It's not the product. It's not funding.
And what do you think are some of the keys to great management for, you know, a company that needs to grow and get to the next level?
It depends on the company itself. Great management, I mean, I came from a school of management where it was do it or be fired. When I went looking for a job, you know, when I was a younger kid in the 80s, there were 25 of my classmates there looking and applying for that same job. So you had to stand out in some way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. And really, it was an employer's world. And being in Nevada, it's a right-to-work state. So you really don't have any rights as an employee. They'll fire you for anything. So you really had to stay up on your game, you know, and work hard. But nowadays, managers, you have your micromanagers, you have your managers that want to be everybody's friend. I mean, it seems that no one takes stock in management anymore. No one's picked up a management book in years. Universities don't teach classes on management like they did in the 80s. You know, and there's millions of management books out there. I just got done reading about four or five really good books, and every single one was published before the 70s.
Right. Well,
you know, and it's interesting because people don't take stock in management as being sexy, so people can't manage themselves, and now they're put in place of you know, a team that needs guidance and collaboration and working together and focusing on goals. The other thing that was interesting about management, I got a ton of management experience when I was in the Army. I mean, the Army was a really, really good place for me to learn management in chaotic and, you know, fundamentally crisis times.
Right, right.
So I think that management needs a big shot in the arm, and management doesn't necessarily mean someone sitting there telling you what to do all the time. I mean, in the absence of leadership, people will follow anybody. You have to have someone there that has leadership capabilities, leadership qualities that people trust, that they like, and that they will follow. I mean, that is paramount to management. If you don't have that, it doesn't matter anything else. If they don't trust you, if they don't see you as a leader, if they don't believe in your ideas, you are not going to be an effective manager.
Excellent. Excellent. Now, in building your companies that you've built and managing them, What key things did you personally focus on versus things that you outsourced or delegated?
One of the things I tried to do is I tried to never outsource anything per se out of the company. The hardest position in any of my companies to hire for, the absolute hardest, was sales and marketing people. Honestly, I know that there's a million salespeople, a million marketing people, but good quality sales and marketing people and copywriters, those were the hardest positions to hire for. I could find hundreds of web developers. I could find hundreds of software developers, security consultants and stuff like that. But to find a really good dyed-in-the-wool salesperson, that was a challenge that I faced with every single company. So I took special interest in sales and marketing out of any company that I built. So every single company I held a sales position in that I ever built. As far as outsourcing, when Telstar got really big, we started looking at maybe outsourcing some telemarketing, outsourcing some regular marketing and PR work, and we had disastrous results. And the reason why I say it is because we all knew our product, we all knew our culture, we all knew our clients, and we tried to convey that. But most of the marketing companies, most of the PR companies, most of the telemarketing companies, they tried to come back and tell us what we wanted. They weren't listening to us, which is, you know, a key trait you need to have in sales is to be able to sit there and listen to what they're saying, build a solution around it, and then reciprocate it back to them. Mm-hmm. And so everybody was telling us what we had to do. Even at the end, Telstar was like, oh, you're not in social networking, you're not going to make any money. They didn't realize that our clients and the people that were making the decision were 50-something-year-old people with hundreds of millions of dollars in budget under control that could barely email. They didn't care about social. They cared about the data centers we built. They cared about, you know, all the circuits we ran. They cared about how the websites look and how we did the programming. Most of them weren't even in the social world at all whatsoever online. And so, I mean, that's one of the big things that you look at is when outsourcing is they have to identify and know what you do and can blend into your culture, not you blend into their culture.
Got it. Got it. Now, with Telstar, you talked about how you had multiple service offerings, and you probably had, you know, you had the sales marketing team, you had lots of other people. How did you manage that in terms of goal setting and number of meetings and managing, you know, metrics? What type of management do you feel is required to grow an organization like that?
I actually believe in the small unit management technique, which is a technique that I've developed throughout the years, and I learned it really in the Army. And what the little small unit management technique is that I like to use is I put only one or two managers with a crew of people in the specific area. So say, for instance, at our office in Salt Lake City, we had one branch manager that watched over the whole office, and then we had two sales guys that report to a sales manager in Reno, and, you know, the branch manager would still overlook and see what was happening there, and we had two tech guys, and so the branch manager oversaw everything that was happening there. The corporate office oversaw everything via reports and stuff like that. We had video conferencing, but we tried to use small units to be highly effective. So we had very well trained, very well paid, small amount of individuals willing to work 8 to 10, 12-hour days to make good money that we would go out and work a client at a time. And I would look at reports daily that we built up that everybody had to submit, and it was real easy to submit. They just went online and had to put in the variables and the information that they did that day, and we'd be able to look at that report. We'd use technology a lot to bridge the gap. We had a really cool voice over IP system that we built over the Asterisk platform, so everybody could call each other. We had it directly connected to our cell phones, so really there was no need for physical meetings. I mean, we'd do Skype. You know, we wanted to physically meet with each other, or if it was a big sale where they needed more people to help them close the sale, we'd fly down there and work with them and help them out. But if you have the right people, they're creative, they're talented, you can trust what they're doing, they're putting in the effort, you're paying them well, you're taking care of them, you've built a community, you know, that fosters this, you're not going to need to sit there and manage people every single day, physically be there every single day. You need to learn how to use technology, save yourself some overhead, and deploy smaller units of people to go out and focus on clients. We didn't go out and advertise and do a ton of stuff to gain clients. We found companies we wanted to work with, or they found us, and then we focused on the people in that company, the decision makers, and presented to them over and over and over again until we got the sale. We didn't go out and spend hundreds of millions of dollars advertising, blabbing to everybody who we were. We saw a big company, and we went after them, and we told them and sold them and marketed them directly why they needed to use our service.
Excellent. I really like hearing and getting talked about hiring and training great people, and I really like – I talk a lot about financial dashboards and metrics, and so you were looking at these financial dashboards and metrics and reports daily, you're saying. Is that correct?
Yeah, and I even had apps that we would write for our laptops and our phones at that time, and it covered everything, websites, sales. I could break them down, and all of these were custom. There wasn't a piece of software, you know, at the time. This was before Salesforce, and eventually Salesforce and Sugar CRM and all of them came online, but they still don't have the modules written the way that we did them, so we wrote them all ourselves.
Got it.
I mean, you have to look at those metrics every day. You have to look at that dashboard every day.
Excellent. So looking at, you know, a couple of things you mentioned, you know, looking at the dashboard, looking at the importance of productivity and management skills. If you had to share, you know, five keys to building a sellable company, you know, what do you think those five things would be?
And money's not one of them.
it could be.
I've never really worried about raising money. I've always built my business out of sales. So I really never use money as a indicator for any company I want to start. I know that sounds funny. Everybody looks at market share and all that, but I really don't look at that. The five key things that I would look at is I would definitely look at technology. The people that I had around me, staff separate from management. I would have management as a third item on there. So I'd look at technology, you know, great staff, great managers. I'd want to look at product longevity. So I didn't want to make a product that could be obsolete in a year or two or something like that. I'd want to make sure that I could make a few. So like if I made a mop that had a new space age material, I'd want to also make sure I could make a duster and, you know, other things that would go along the same product family. So there had to be some longevity to the product cycle itself. And then the last thing I'd look for is competition. I'd make sure that other people in the marketplace already had something kind of like this so I could go out and beat it. I wouldn't want to come out there right off the bat and say, oh, I've invented this brand new product. No one in the world has it. I got to now I'm going to invent my marketplace and all that. That's way too expensive to do. Let somebody else carry the burden of inventing the marketplace. And then after they've done that, I'm going to come in and offer something better.
Got it. So as you mentioned a couple times, letting someone else create that marketplace, you coming in, the market's already educated. It's a lot easier as long as you show them something better,
right,
you can then execute on it.
Right, and it's okay to invent a new product in that market segment. But imagine if the internet wasn't built and Twitter came about first. How successful do you think Twitter would be? Because the internet's not even here yet, you know,
right,
and they're going to spend hundreds of millions of dollars. I remember when the internet was coming about and I was leaving the bulletin board systems to go to the internet. People didn't even have their offices cabled for a network. They were still using a sneaker net network. They weren't even using regular cabled networks in their office, and now email's about, and we have to educate them not only on, you know, networking their computers and why it's important, but email and where your data goes. And it was really expensive in the late 90s, you know, to get people online and to get things going, and then they got to pay for a $1,500 a month T1 line to get to this thing called the internet. Are you crazy? So let them invent the market first, then come out with a better product.
Got it. Now, when you talk about, you know, technology, people, staff, people, management, product longevity, competition, when looking at a company like Telzar, what was it about Telzar that you had built that made it an exciting acquisition candidate for a buyer?
There was one thing that I did really, really good, and there's one thing that I did really, really bad.
Okay.
I made a company a one-stop IT shop where anybody could go. But that company was so complex that I had to have three top big companies come in and acquire three different pieces of that company because no one wanted to offer all those services. So I see it as a success, but I also see it as a failure because I built a company that offered too many services, and that if, you know, small amounts of people left or they didn't have the right managers in place, those services wouldn't, you know, produce the results that I had already put in. So when you went to Telzar, it was only one company, the only company that I still know of in the world where you can go in and afford their services and get a website built, get software written for you, buy computers, buy laptops, have them set up, get network and security and intrusion services, you know, have everything done under the sun. The client didn't have to do anything. But because of that, someone coming in to acquire us, they had to continue to offer those services. We also did weird stuff like we never ever raised our rates. That blew everybody away. There was a clause in our contracts that said, you know, there is an opportunity for us to raise our rates, and that was the only way that we were able to sell our IT outsource business.
Got it. We
never raised our rates. So you signed up services with us in Telzar in 1999. When the company sold in 2010, you were still paying the same rates per hour. So at that point in time, our engineering rates, each year we would increase our engineering rates for non-contract clients. So if someone would come in and sign a contract, they'd pay those newer rates. So we had people in 2010 still paying $65 an hour for a certified engineer. And in 2010, if you came on as a new client, you'd pay $250 an hour for that same engineer.
Got it.
And so there were some things that I did really, really well. But by making a company that did everything under the sun and was so complex, I did have a really hard time. We started selling Telzar in 2007. It wasn't done until 2010. And that was a failure on my part. And I will always see that as a failure, not as a success.
Got it. So it's actually, would you recommend to other entrepreneurs that they should focus more on one, you know, one thing rather than diversifying so much?
Well, it took years to diversify that much. What I would tell them to focus on is focus on that one product first, focus on the sales, get it out there. Don't worry about getting your name out. You know, don't worry about getting big, you know, interviews and being on huge social networks right off the bat and hoping that, you know, you send one thing to Facebook and it goes viral. It doesn't work that way. Focus locally right now on your one product that you have, push it, build some sales up, build yourself a little bit of a buffer, and then start hiring people and slowly expand your business out. Don't rush it, but focus on that one product first. And if you're focusing on that product, you're focusing on the technology in your industry, you can only but innovate. I mean, you will have to innovate to stay ahead. You will have multiple products.
Excellent.
But do it organically. Don't try to artificially start offering 50,000 products your first day you open, because you'll never be able to do it.
Agreed. Now, you said that to sell all the business units took 3 years. Can you talk through a little bit about what happens during the acquisition process so the entrepreneurs and business owners listening could really understand that process a little more?
About the process of selling it to the three different companies, or about the aspects of
about just the whole process of what they should be aware of in if they expect to sell the company in, let's say, 3 years, what would they have to think about and be aware of?
One of the things is it depends on how much experience you have in building companies. I had a lot of experience in building companies. I had a lot of great attorneys and CPAs. So I had a team of people already around me that we all knew our skill sets. If you don't have that, I would hire a business broker, and I would research licensed business brokers to sell the company for you, honestly, because it's such a headache. If you thought buying a house was hard or buying a car, you don't have any clue until you sell that business how difficult it can be. And especially if the company like Telzar has patents, copyrights, I mean, you have to figure out who owns what, who's buying what are they paying for, where do the rights go. I mean, the bigger the company, the more complex and the harder it is. And so if you don't have that experience, I would, for at least the first company, hire a business broker.
Got it. And looking at
We spent thousands of dollars even doing it ourselves with attorneys and CPAs, documenting everything, licensing everything, waiting for the USPTO to get back to us to tell us about copyrights and, you know, assets being switched over to another company. So, I mean, I would honestly, you know, hire a business broker.
Got it. Agreed. Now, you mentioned different aspects of Telzar units, such as your client contracts, your copyrights and patents, and your team. What do you think made Telzar so appealing to acquirers? Were those the key attributes? Things like was it revenues? Was it your profit margins? Was it your client contracts? Was it all of that? I want people to understand what makes a company valuable to, and why would an acquirer, they have, you know, the build versus buy decision. Why would they buy you versus trying to build what you have already built?
Well, that's actually an interesting question, and I think it goes by industry. In our particular industry with Telzar, if you've been following the news, which everybody pretty much has for the last 2 years, tech acquisitions are at an all-time high. Mm-hmm. Time to market is so much faster now. You can develop a product, innovate a product, and have it ready to go within about a week. I mean, it's not a big enterprise product, but you can, with technology, you can develop stuff so much faster now. There are so many bridges that can be crossed so quick. So really, the number one thing why they acquired us was market share. I mean, it's the age-old truth. Cash is king. We had a profitable business. We had a lot of market share. We became a thorn in their side, like I was telling you earlier, because we were taking business, you know, away from them, taking, you know, food off of their table, so to speak. And they wanted that market share. I don't think that the companies that acquired us had so much money. I don't think that we were geniuses and we were doing anything special in the world that anybody else couldn't do it if they applied themselves and knew the industry really, really well. We were just doing it at a fraction of the price because we were heavily using technology, which is something that they weren't. And they were technology companies, which is odd.
Got it.
So we're beating them at their own game. Go ahead.
So the use of technology to lower your cost was one of your competitive advantages. Is that correct?
Definitely. And our size. See, by having a small mobile team, by having your little mobile workforces out there, your small teams, we were competing against companies that had 50,000, 100,000 employees. They couldn't get down their prices as low as we were. Our operations were lean. From the start, the day we opened the doors, from the start all the way until the end, we always kept very lean operations. Most of the money that was made went into either our war chest, so to speak, so that we could do acquisitions on our own and have a little bit of breathing room. And it went to our employees. We paid our employees incredibly well. And when you look at what we paid our employees and you look at the market averages in the areas that we employed these people, it was like 25% more. And the bigger companies can't afford to do that. They have hundreds of thousands of employees. They can't do that. So you need to be highly mobile, utilize technology, and keep your overhead low. Become a thorn in their side. Start taking market share. They couldn't even compete with us on quotes.
Got it. Now, in becoming a thorn in their side, would you recommend sacrificing some of your profitability if you didn't have as low a cost structure as you did? Would you recommend, you talked about, you know, preparing for the sale and becoming more of a thorn in their side. Would that be something you would consider, you know, lowering your prices as needed to get in and become more of a thorn? Or do you have the mindset of you have to keep your profitability as is?
You have to keep your profitability as is. I mean, especially as you get closer to the acquisition time. One of the biggest failures is if you do the sale yourself, is that so much of your effort is in on the exit itself and watching the sale and watching your money that you're not watching your company. And one of the mm-hmm. biggest failures of an entrepreneur is when you are selling your company, letting your sales drop. That's not good, because when they come in and do their final audit before they give you the actual factual totals, and they see that your numbers have dropped 25% because you haven't been watching your company, you've been watching the acquisition, they have a new negotiational point, and I promise you 100% they're going to back you down on the number. So you right. have to maintain your sales, your profitability during the whole process, and that's even more of a reason to hire a broker or hire a few more people that have done this before, so that you can keep your profitability up, keep your company where it's at, and ride it out. Some of the fastest business sales I've ever seen have been about 12 months. I've never seen a business sell for less than 12 months. Right. I've heard of people selling companies in 6 months, but these are tiny companies. If you have a company that's worth a few million dollars, they need time to, you know, go in and advertise the company to people, potential people that want to buy it. Another reason to use a business broker. They have to go out and find suitors for you. They have to put financing together. They have to do audits of your company. It takes at least a year or so to do that. It took me three.
Got it. Excellent. Excellent. Now, as we start to wrap things up, you know, what do you think our listeners should be doing in the next 30 days, perhaps 90 days, and perhaps the next year to progress their businesses so that they move closer to getting their business ready to have someone want to buy it?
Okay, the first thing I do, and this is going to sound weird, but you got to hear my theory on this, I would stop cutting costs. People have cut costs to the bone, that now they're actually stepping over dollars to pick up pennies. Now they're not in the optimum. Now they're understaffed. Quit cutting your costs. You've gotten your business to a specific point. You think your business is ready for, you know, you're a great target for an acquisition. Great. Maintain what you're doing now. Continue to be aggressive to acquire as many new clients as you can, all the way up until the day you sell the company. Never stop. If you could even double your sales or add more into your sales, do it. It's going to look better. If you are preparing for it, one of the things that people don't look at is entrepreneurs, we have to constantly be doing something. We have to be building companies. We have to be building businesses. We actually do a seminar with people that have sold their companies, and they don't know what to do. They're besides themselves. They've been to Europe 50 times. They've been to Hawaii 100 times. They own houses all over. They don't physically know what to do, and their health is suffering because of it. And so you have to figure out, after you sell your company, what's your next step? Of course, you're going to take some time off, spend time with your family and all that. But I was planning on taking an entire year off. And then I got a ton of offers to do, you know, to work with people with Boeing Ventures. So I said, all right, I'll take 6 months off. And then another week came in and I got some more offers. And I said, okay, I'm going to take 90 days off. I went from selling my company on a Sunday to Monday being on a new job, you know, working with new clients. And, right. and I didn't take any time off. And so I failed to properly plan and execute that strategy and follow it through. I was going to promote my book for the next year, travel and all that. Well, right. now, you know, I advised all these companies, and I'm in the middle of things, and now here I am in a new business. So you have to plan what you're going to do and execute it and figure it out. I mean, retiring on an island in Fiji with $100 million, that sounds fantastic. But I'm going to tell you, especially after living on an island, you can only fish so much. You can only right. drive around it so much. You have to have purpose in your life and to do something else. Volunteer, help startups, but you have to do something else. So when your company does sell, and it will, what are you going to do?
Excellent. And just a final question for you, which is, you know, what else should the entrepreneurs and business owners listening to this call know about building a business so that they can successfully exit that I may not have asked you about?
I mean, sticking to your guns. We pretty much talked about that. Being true to what your product is. becoming a thorn in someone's side so you get a higher acquisition price, making sure you're keeping your sales up throughout the whole thing. I guess it would be you have to make sure that you have some great attorneys and great CPAs double-checking all the paperwork, double-checking all the laws in your area, looking at any litigations that are pending or open or outstanding. These are things that normal entrepreneurs might not have the skill set to know or to do, but just to make sure that the whole sale is finalized. The other thing that you have to do that kind of almost bit us in the butt is make sure every single credit line and account and anything that's personally guaranteed by you is paid for, closed, and your name is pulled off of it. I had a company I sold about 7 years ago, and these people went in, and we had, you know, everybody's social security numbers and documentation and all of that of past employees in there. And one of the people that they fired had stole one of our past employees' identity who didn't work there, and they actually got credit. So, I mean, these are things that you have to think about nowadays to close out. Just because they're buying your company doesn't mean they're going to be a steward of that business like you were. So make sure that you've checked all these things out. Make sure you have documentation. You know, make sure if it's just an acquisition of your client base versus an acquisition of your entire company, that the debt's been identified, who's going to pay what, when is it going to be paid, when is my name going to be taken off of this for liability. I mean, that's what a great attorney and CPA and business broker are going to do for you.
Excellent. Thanks, Jeff. This has been great. Everybody, definitely encourage you to check out what Jeff's doing. Two places you can go to, bowlingventures.com. I found Jeff on your personal site, jeffbowling.com, JeffBowling.com. You can check out more of what Jeff has done and check out his book, which I definitely encourage you to read. Very, very, very great, interesting, and enjoyable story. So, Jeff, thanks again for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.